So everyone we know is online right now, by the way, is on Skype right now.
Oh, I don't. Do you mean like friends and such?
Yeah, Leland's online, Patrick's online, Kate is online, and Kyle from the Kaiju Cast are all on Skype right now.
Oh, let's just dial them all out. What did you think about The Bronze? Because you definitely probably saw it, right?
This is a movie everybody saw. Yeah. Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. This week with me is Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And this week with me is Cassidy Robinson. You sounded like it usually isn't. You sounded conflicted.
I was a little bit. I try to find new ways of doing the same thing over and over again, so I don't feel like I'm going insane.
But I mean, that's life, though.
What have you done with your life?
What have I done with my life? I've just been super focused, trying to finish this thing up. I've been writing like a madman. I'm on the second to last or last chapter right now.
Mm-hmm.
Of the book, and it's so close. It's so close.
So close you can taste it?
Oh my gosh, it hurts. But I'm excited, except for, I mean, that's just the first draft, and then mm-hmm. move into the editing process, and it's just as long and arduous. And so I don't know how I feel.
I have your ending.
You do?
I have your ending, and it will only take a couple pages to do.
Oh, okay.
Like 700 words tops. Lead character, like, walks away from the rest of the characters. I have no idea what's happening at this point in your book, but I'm sure your lead character is next to other characters. Walks away, and then finds a time machine. It's buried somewhere in the woods. Walks into the time machine, and then it ends up not being a time machine at all, but actually, like, some device that takes him through wormholes in space.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he appears on the other side of it, he is greeted by an alien that is in the appearance of his father, so as not to scare him too much. Okay. And he explains the origins of the universe.
Well, that's not far from my ending. It's pretty close, but...
Oh, see, that might be a problem for you, because I was joking.
And oh, no.
That's also the ending of Contact.
I know it is. I was mostly joking. That isn't nearly bloody or crazy enough to be my ending.
And then he shoots the alien. Says, "Fuck you! You don't know my life."
Yeah,
and
that's gets
back into the not time machine and goes back to the battlefield
and kills them all.
Right.
Yeah. No. Well. Yeah. Something like that. Well, I mean, plots. If we're really getting into that, those are a dime of the dozen. So
sure.
So, I mean, we could probably point out, if we wanted to, we could be one of those YouTube videos that points out how one movie is like several other movies, even though lots of movies are like other movies. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So
today we're going to be talking about the comedy, the dark comedy, The Bronze, which nobody saw.
We did. Two people
saw it, and we're going to discuss it. And at the end of the episode, we're also going to review Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist, which you assigned me something like 2 weeks ago.
Well, I assigned you to assign to me.
Yes.
That's what happened. I verified it through our logs of history.
You called our archivist and yes. asked him if he can confirm or deny who assigned what.
Well, I called our intern to tell our archivist. I took that straight from Leland.
Can we get an intern? Okay, let's go ahead and just get into the news. And we're going to do another lightning round because you've been posting news like a madman lately.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And we got a lot here. I've got some serious phlegm issues. I think this is the first time I've actually vocalized today.
I think I come off strange because I haven't talked to anybody except for myself and my head to the computer for like 3 or 4 hours. And
right.
Then we do the show and I'm like, oh.
Let's go ahead and get into this. Looks like Oscar Isaac is going to reunite with Ex Machina director Alex Garland for another film called Annihilation. Do you know anything about this movie? What is it about?
I don't know, and I don't care. You want to know why?
Why? It's
fucking Alex Garland and Oscar Isaac.
Right.
Apparently Natalie Portman might be in it too. But I really, honestly, even if Oscar Isaac wasn't in this, just for Alex Garland alone, I would be interested.
I found the part of the article that talked about what the movie is. Annihilation centers on a team of 4 women who set out on a dangerous mission where the laws of nature don't apply. They are to explore Area X, a mysterious landscape that is destroyed almost every expedition that's set out on it. So it's well-worn kind of sci-fi territory. A crew goes to investigate a bad place out in the middle of space. But if, you know, Alex Garland's going to be doing it, which he kind of did already with Sunshine, I'm into it. I'll watch it.
Well, that's the thing is he does do, like, if you just think about his plots are, like, usually all the setups are just basic genre stuff.
Yeah.
He just does them so well, and so it feels so fresh, and it is done so well, you just don't care. So, again, Alex Garland, lightning rounded, I'm going to watch it.
All right.
Everybody else should go watch it.
You want to read off the next one?
Yeah, Suicide Squad is undergoing expensive reshoots because of Deadpool. Deadpool has been doing really well. It's been doing really well around the world. It's been setting new rated R blockbuster whatever highlights and records and blah, blah, blah.
Right. It's specifically been doing really well for its budget because it wasn't, I think it was like on the low end of high budget and the high end of mid budget.
Yeah. If you're including all of it,
the marketing.
It's
a mid,
yeah. If you're including marketing, it's higher, but if you're not including marketing, it's like a mid budget.
Sure.
Suicide Squad, I think is a higher budget. I'm pretty sure it's not a lower budget. It's, you know, DC trying to still save themselves. They're trying to do these reshoots, I guess, to make it more funny, because if something they learned was, you know, we can be funny, that's okay.
It's okay.
Right.
It's okay.
Well,
especially when half your characters are in some relation to the Joker.
Or slightly insane supervillains in their own regard as well.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, just to have a little bit of personality. I mean, there are several types of humor. You don't just have to be like, you know, broad comedy. Even Deadpool wasn't that. So,
Well, okay. So I don't think this sounds very good. I think this sounds pretty desperate at this point, especially when they're trying to rejigger the whole thing so that it's like a recently released movie. It would be different if it was like, oh, well, you know, we could punch up the scene, or we could do this, or we could do that. But it sounds like they're looking at the success of an entirely different model and then trying to apply it to something they already had finished. I don't know. My cautious optimism is now starting to slide down to expect a disappointment.
If the scenario you just put forth is true, then yes, absolutely. The movie, I think basically it can have that humor. Again, I halfway trust David Ayer. So we'll see. I just don't know. I'm never really actually that cautiously optimistic or pessimistic. I'm usually just like, we'll see what it is.
Right.
So for me specifically with this one, I'm kind of like that. Superhero movies in general have so many reshoots that I don't know if it really bodes that well or that poorly. You always hear about reshoots with these big films.
That's true. Lightning round.
Lightning round.
Sofia Coppola to write direct remake of Clint Eastwood drama The Beguiled. Have you ever seen The Beguiled?
Nope.
Neither have I. Lightning round.
Moving on. David Oyelowo is going to star in God Particle. It's with Gugu Mbatha-Raw. Sorry, I apologize to whoever whose name that is. Basically this is about some like astronauts that are up on a crew that are on this like space station, and they think they've destroyed the world through a Hadron Collider. Then these other spaceships from these other nations come, and they're going to come on board, and they're going to be hostile and things are going to happen, blah, blah, blah. It's,
right.
You know, I this is done by a bad robot, so that's kind of why I did that. And I can already tell the mysterious, you know.
Did they or did they not actually destroy the planet? I guess will probably be the big question here. I like David Oyelowo, and I really like how every time you say his name, it's completely different from the last time.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's a good actor, and he's been doing good work. And I, you know, Bad Robot, I give them a lot of shit, and I think a lot of people give them a lot of shit because they're a little too into their gimmicks. But I think generally, more times than not, their stuff is of quality.
It's at least pretty good.
Yeah, it's at least interesting. There's at least a hook, even if it doesn't totally deliver.
Yeah, at worst, it's mediocre.
Right. I'd be into this.
Oh, yeah, I'm totally into this. And actually, it piques my interest at least this far.
Will Ferrell to star in North Pole Expedition movie. You posted this one, so I don't know that much about it.
So I'm just a fan of Will Ferrell. I think he can be pretty funny. This is actually based on a semi-true story about some guys that got an insurance salesman who got drunk with some friends at a bar, and then they decided to go on an expedition to the North Pole. And so they get on their snowmobiles and just kind of do it. I mean, I think that they prepare and do all that, but right. I don't know if this is going to be like more like dramedy, which he can do.
And he's
a perfectly capable actor. Or if this is going to be one of his broader comedies, either way, I'll probably give it a look-see. It does have just the premise sounds somewhat fun though to me. So
yeah, I mean, it could work as a comedy or drama or both. Like, did you ever see that episode of Survivor Man? Which one is Bear Grylls? I don't care. Did you ever see that show? The episode that Will Ferrell was on?
No.
Like for some reason he was a guest. And they're like trying to survive the wilderness together, and Will Ferrell's like cracking wise the whole time, and like Bear Grylls is trying to, like, you know, he has to put in all this voiceover to try and make it sound like they're in a lot more danger than we know they are, because Will Ferrell's just joking the whole time.
Right. I haven't, but he always pops up in random shit.
That's all I can think about with this project.
Maybe that's partly where it's being inspired from.
Maybe. Lightning round. This is the last one. Joel McHale is set to play Chevy Chase in a National Lampoon's biopic. You pointed out the irony of this, mostly because they co-starred in the TV show Community. And I guess Joel McHale is kind of our modern-day Chevy Chase. He's a smart aleck in kind of that sort of National Lampoon's era Chevy Chase way.
Well, I immediately think of what Bill Murray said to Chevy Chase as an insult on Saturday Night Live, that story, where he calls him a medium talent. and I think that's kind of true about both of them. And, well, I enjoy both of them. I just couldn't help but think of that and be like, yeah, that works. He's supposed to specifically play him during the National Lampoon, like, era. And right. Specifically about kind of... Yeah, and specifically when they were making one of those movies, it's called A Futile and a Stupid Gesture. I think it's through Netflix or something, one of them streaming devices. Depending on, you know what, Netflix has, I kind of like their stuff, even when it's kind of schlocky.
Yeah.
So I would give this a shot.
Yeah.
Sounds like a fun premise. And specifically, I know that Chevy Chase and from the article I know, and from random rumors and stuff going around celebrity blogs or whatever you want to call them, that Joe McHale and Chevy Chase kind of have, like, while they're kind of writing partners, they're also very antagonistical and kind of dislike each other a lot of times, frenemies, if you will.
I think that more than anything, that's what makes this project interesting, is because he worked directly with Chevy Chase, and everything you ever read about Chevy Chase is that he's a huge douchebag.
Right.
And he sucks to work with, and he will call people out and throw fits all over the place, and is a misogynist and a homophobe and just generally speaking a terrible person. So if they want to do this and they want to go for it, it kind of puts Joel McHale in an awkward position, because he's like, oh yeah, we work together on the show, so am I going to portray him exactly like how everyone is confirmed he is? Like, literally, nobody has ever come out against those statements. Everyone's like, yeah, he's pretty much the worst.
So, yeah, I'm pretty into the idea and into the idea that how they're going to portray this. Mm. So I if it goes in those lines, the way that you've set that up, I would be totally into it.
Yeah, me too. Warts and all.
Yeah.
And that's lightning round for the news. So let's go ahead and get into our review. And like we said, this isn't a movie that did particularly well. It opened semi-wide, I think, but this was released.
Well, first, it did particularly not well. It's they were comparing its box office open to like the Oogie Loves and things like that.
Yeah, I don't think it was that low, but it did. They kind of misjudged, I think, the type of release they gave it. The movie is The Bronze, and this was originally released, promoted out of Sundance. The movie stars Melissa Rauch and is co-wrote by her as well. And I guess people probably know her the best as Howard's girlfriend from The Big Bang Theory.
Mm-hmm. A wife now.
Oh, I haven't been keeping up. I didn't know that they have been matrimoned.
My wife loves that show. We watch it quite often, so I know all the digs about Big Bang.
There you go. And actually, funnily enough, we reviewed Talladega Nights not that long ago, and this is very similar in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. Including Gary Cole features quite heavily as the main character's father, but playing a very different type here. In this, Melissa Rauch plays a Olympic gymnast or ex-Olympic gymnast who trained all of her childhood to go to the Olympics. And when she did, it was kind of a bittersweet experience because she hurt her ankle so bad that it pretty much rendered her unable to ever perform again. But it was in this kind of glorious, you know, TV moment where she was able to halfway make a landing and still manage to get the goal or get the bronze with a broken ankle. So she's in part sort of immortalized as a hero, but also that was the end of her career. And she lives in small town Ohio and is pretty bitter about it. She still never really kind of got over the fact that her moment of glory is long since over, and she struts around like she's the queen of this small town and everyone kind of placates her. She's living with her father, unemployed, and he would like her to get a job. And in that journey, she finds out that her original coach, who taught her when she was a child, has just died and is willing to leave her a fat inheritance if she trains this new Olympic ingenue underneath her, who's, you know, squeaky clean and cute as a button and has never done or said anything inappropriate in her entire life, unlike Rauch, who now has become a bitter, horrible, filthy person. And comedy ensues. What did you think of The Bronze?
Oh, it's got a very strange tone.
It does.
It's kind of shot like a very realistic drama, but the characters are very much larger than life. Well, some of the characters also, not all of the characters. Specifically, Melissa Rauch's character and a couple of the other gymnasts, the dude gymnast, whatever his name is, played by the Sebastian Stan. I was going to say by the Winter Soldier.
Oh, that now, is who that is, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Oh, man, it's not I was all... trying to place him the entire movie. And Thomas Middleditch from Silicon Valley's in there as her, like, would-be love interest, and he's doing a pretty broad performance as well, considering the tone of the movie. He's doing this kind of, you know, one of his dweeby kind of SNL-like characters.
He does. I like Thomas Middleditch, though, and I do actually quite a bit like his performance in it. I like his character, and I think it's kind of like a weird meeting ground between the regular characters and the weird characters.
Right.
Because the other ones are so pompous and he's just so not because of his, he's got this twitch that happens.
Right.
And he's done years of therapy to try to get it, corrected. To get it in place and corrected, and he just cannot. And
right.
So I really actually dug his character. Now, it took me a while to kind of warm up just because the tone is so strange to this film. But as 3 weeks have passed for me, I can't say I super love the movie, but I can't say that I disliked it either. I kind of had a fun time with some of it. And
uh-huh.
I maybe it's just because I've had to keep thinking about it for the podcast for 3 weeks, but it's actually, I come up fairly organically with me being like, oh, that's sort of weird. There's also much to everybody, because the only news that came out that I ever saw about this film is about this insane sex scene that happens.
Yeah.
It's like, it's almost, it is funny, but for me, I sat forward. It was almost like fucking watching body horror or something. Because it's shocking and so much.
It's shot really weird. And I think, you know, you really kind of identified the movie's problem right away, and that's in the direction. Yeah, the movie's directed by Brian Buckley, and he wasn't involved with the writing. And in a lot of ways, I feel like he's making a different movie. Like, the score is like this kind of mournful piano score a lot of the times. And over top these scenes that should be kind of bubbly and fun.
Mm-hmm.
And the lighting is usually either a lot of natural lighting and handheld camera stuff, or in the case of like that sex scene, it's like weirdly dark. And it, even though it's goofy stuff happening on the camera, and it should elicit a lot of kind of, oh my God, I can't believe they're doing this ridiculous sex scene, almost like the puppet scene from Team America. Like, mm-hmm. That should be the way you feel about it, but it ends up just kind of coming off as disturbing.
But as time has passed, I've kind of wondered if this was shot like just like a broad comedy,
mm-hmm.
and taken just like a broad comedy, and everything was like little setups and gags, if I would have remembered it as much.
Maybe not. I mean, I think there's a happy medium in there. I think what Agreed. They were going for is, because the movie's low budget,
mm-hmm.
I think they thought, I mean, I can't confirm this or anything, but I think the idea was, if we bring a sense of kind of realism to it, and this kind of Sundance ready packaging, that people will take it more seriously as a satire than they will as a Will Ferrell comedy, which mm-hmm. genetically it's a lot more similar to.
Well, I would even argue that a lot of Will Ferrell comedies are actually satires. And
well, just... yeah, but you know what? I think the movie wants us to think that it's something closer to a Citizen Ruth or an Election.
Sure.
Even like a Heathers, maybe. But it's, in reality, it's a lot broader than even those movies, and it doesn't have as much to say, generally. Mm-hmm. It's other than kind of poking fun at the Olympic celebrity world, and in that sort of Alexander Payne-ish way, it's kind of making fun of Middle America, but
lovingly making fun of Middle
America. Yeah, in a knowing, like, we're from here, so we're allowed to make fun of it sort of way. And I'll say right away, despite all of that, I think the tone is a problem, but I think despite that, Melissa Rauch owns this character 100%.
She's talking warts and all. This movie starts off like warts and all. Like,
oh, right. Pretty... Yeah. I mean, from that opening, we expect like, whoa, this movie's going to be a ride. And it doesn't ever really live up to that strong of an opening.
Well, except for body horror scene, like I said. I agree with you. It isn't a perfect movie. It's got some rough edges. But overall, I think I'm kind of positive. I lean towards positive with the movie. Uh-huh. Because I do think that, like you said, I think Melissa Rauch, she owns it and pulls off the character. I actually think Sebastian Stan kind of does his
thing. He does too. Okay. Yeah, I really enjoy, they both get to be as awful as they want to be, and they're both really good at it.
Well, even the young gymnast, which we haven't talked about a lot, I think she plays her character very realistic, almost to the T's, but then by the end, you're like, oh, she wasn't a real character. So I don't know. That as an acting piece, I think it works, and as a comedy, I think it works. I think the tone is very strange. However, I'm not completely against or for, but it does definitely make you go, okay, I'm not sure exactly. Maybe if the movie had a bigger budget and more time, those two things, and which usually go together,
yeah,
maybe this would be, you know, look like something a little bit more polished. And
well, I think they embraced the non-polished aspect of it. I think that's really what, I don't think that they were necessarily working against themselves. I think they thought like, oh, we'll go for this style. And I just don't think that style fits that screenplay or those performances.
Well, this is also produced through the Duplass brothers.
Yeah, Duplass brothers stuff. And you know, I'm starting with the negatives, but I actually do think there's enough here that makes it worthwhile. I think, like I said, mm-hmm. Melissa Rauch is really does own this character in a very Reese Witherspoon and Election kind of way. Like, she's totally unapologetic about the character and owns up to the character's awfulness and really plays up to it. She gets a ton of great one-liners.
But she doesn't see the one thing that makes both of those performances work is mm-hmm. the fact that both of them, even though they're playing these awful characters, they still have a human side, and they're still not completely like, oh, they're, you know, just the worst. They actually have some, like,
well, there's something sort of a redemption story, like in a very similar way to Talladega Nights. And actually, it's probably my least favorite aspect of it when it, you know, I don't know if this is a spoiler or not, but at the end, when she has to realize that how awful she's been, I actually think the movie cops out a little, and I would maybe appreciate just kind of letting her fail and be awful, like just, you know,
we talked about a lot of movies that are similar. I also thought of like Greenberg and that kind of stuff, because she is that awful of an unlikable character a lot of the time.
Right, but it doesn't have any of the nuance of a Bombach script.
Like, well, it's not the same. It's not trying to be the same thing. So it's in this strange middle ground between all these things I mentioned.
Right.
But again, you are right. It doesn't come off perfect. It didn't blow me away. But at the same time, I was like, you know what? I had a lot more fun with this. And honestly, even though this character is like sort of horrible, and we do see some shows like that. Like, I mean, even if you want to like HBO's Eastbound and Down.
Sure.
Like it's sort of very similar too. I still don't feel like, you know, this doesn't feel so like typical. It actually feels atypical enough that you're kind of like, okay, I can kind of get behind this more than like some like bro comedy or some girl bro comedy that usually comes out around this time. So overall, I was just kind of pleased with it. And I think that a lot of people would dig it.
Yeah. And there's a ton of great performances in here. I like Gary Cole again. He's becoming one of my favorite, like, you know, unsung character actors. And when I don't think I appreciate him enough when he does show up in movies, but I'm going to start. I think he's really good here as the overly patient father. I think Middleditch is, I think it's a little, the performance is a little mannered, but I think it fits in with the world that they've created. And I like the specificity of both the sport that they're sending up and you know, well, like the way they handle like the training montage and that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I think overall I met my quota for laughs to justify the movie's existence.
Well, it is a comedy, but there is also a drama aspect to it. So I wasn't so interested in how many laughs per se. Mm-hmm. But it all goes back to that strange tone, which I'm not completely over the moon, but not completely against. It's this sort of weird middle ground.
Yeah.
But again, it didn't blow me away. This isn't something I'll probably return to. But if you're looking for a fun comedy to kind of just, or a fun comedy slash kind of, I guess, drama, I don't know. Just to kind of take your mind off of things for a little bit, I think that this is a decent one.
Yeah, it's acceptable. And I think that that Rauch in particular really comes off well here, both as a writer and as a performer. And if all you know her from is The Big Bang Theory, which, you know, she doesn't get to do a ton. Mm-hmm. Here you get to see a lot of versatility in what she's capable of doing in different types of characters. And I think that despite how poorly this movie did, I think that it will open doors for her.
Well, I guess they're still doing funny promos for it and stuff, because because for how small this film is, to open as wide as they did is actually, it was pretty bold of them.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't pay off, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's why, you know, there are sites comparing it to the Oogie Loves and stuff like that. Specifically, I think it is bold of them and good for them kind of at that level too, because sometimes you need a smaller film to challenge the world.
No, yeah, so. And I could see it having a life outside of the theatrical release. I could see it becoming something of a cult film for a specific type of audience.
Agreed.
I could see this like having, like, I guess there's no such thing as a video success anymore, but you know, if it ends up on Netflix and people catch it later or whatever, I could see like people a few years from now going, actually, that movie is worth looking at.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that people, if you're into like these kind of raunchy comedies, check this out. This is a fun one.
Yeah, certainly. At least for the performance. Yes.
Yeah. Agreed.
Okay. Let's get into our last review. This is Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist, which came out in 1970. He is an Italian filmmaker. He's made a lot of movies, you know, since then, obviously, like Last Tango in Paris and The Last Emperor and a bunch of movies. And I think what he's trying to get at for the most part here is he's talking a lot about Italy towards the end of the fascist era when Mussolini was in power. The main character, played by Jean-Louis Trintignant, I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly, he plays this kind of know-nothing military or Secret Service stooge who's trying to work his ranks up the fascist government. And at the same time, he is recently engaged and he's trying to sort of get his premarital life together when he is given the assignment to knock off his old philosophy professor who lives in France. And so him and his girlfriend kind of take a road trip down there to meet him and his new wife, who live a very different kind of lifestyle and are very decadent and not fascist. And, you know, it's kind of a battle of ideologies for a lot of the movie. Specifically, it's sort of an internal battle with the lead character who, you know, trying to get the umption to go through with his assignment while sort of reconciling his future plans and his station in life and whatever. And that pretty much sums her up. What did you feel about The Conformist?
I recommended this to you to recommend me because, sure. This was one of the ones that Netflix highly recommended. So I was like, okay, I didn't know much about it. It was a thriller of sorts and from the '70s. I was like, that sounds up my alley. I didn't know that it was Bernardo Bertolucci, kind of out of the whole Italian, I don't even know it scene. But if you're looking for a plot, mm-hmm. this film doesn't have, like, these kind of films are not plot heavy. So at first I was looking for, like, your kind of more, I guess, a more boilerplate kind of thriller.
Yeah, which, and it's in there, but that's certainly not what the movie's concerned with.
It's a loose psychological thriller. And maybe has some scenes that are like more like that, but it's not like that at all. That being said, that 30-minute mark, I paused the movie. I looked up, oh, this is who this is from. And then I just completely go, okay, turn off the plot brain. And then once I turned off the plot brain and started looking at kind of like the symbolism, the decor. I mean, that basically when you're looking at these, you're looking at the themes. What is the theme telling me?
Right.
And so as I started watching for that, it's like, oh, so we're talking about broadly about how, you know, the like bigger like idea of how the Italian populace reacted under fascist and Mussolini. Yeah.
I think a lot of it has to deal with specifically in the same way that Salo kind of deals with it. And I would be interested to know if there were a lot of, like, you're more into Fellini than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Did he or any of his other contemporaries ever tackle this subject? Because it seems like those two movies, specifically this one and Salo, are really kind of dealing with the recent history of we were kind of part of this and we have to own up to that. And there's kind of a healing process or a psychological healing process that's still going on in their culture.
Not very similarly. The thing about these kind of films is they're dense.
Yeah.
And it does take more than one viewing, and it does take a lot to think about. And I've done a bastardized version and watched all of them like once or twice. So I don't know if I would say that Fellini really hasn't didn't really do, if he did do a version of that, it was more through a satire kind of lens, and it was felt a little bit lighter and more silly.
Right.
Definitely not as dark as The Conformist, or probably, I haven't seen Solo, but I can only imagine and frighten
probably
by.
Not as dark as that either. Although all three were sort of come from the same world of, you know, out of Italian neorealism into sort of what was considered the Italian New Wave at this time.
Is it surrealism? What is it technically, like the...
Well, it depends on which director you're talking about. If you're talking about Fellini, he definitely dealt in surrealism.
Okay.
But if you're talking about Bertolucci, there's kind of more symbolism going on here than some of his movies. And then if you're, you know, Antonioni and Visconti, they were kind of, I don't know, they had their own style as well.
Italy
in the 60s and 70s was a booming art film scene.
Right. I guess for me, it's hard to call this realistic because of just the weird sort of dreamlike continuity.
Right. It was, yes, by this point, once you get out of the 40s and 50s into the 60s and 70s, it was less neorealism in that Bicycle Thieves kind of way, or even like early Fellini and early Bertolucci, and it started to become a little bit more dreamlike and a little bit more symbolic in nature.
Okay. Well, I mean, this is 1970s on the dot, so I mean that, yeah, that really on the timeline scale, and if I'm thinking of Fellini's body of work, that makes sense.
Right.
This film really does dive into those kind of, like you called it, the traumas of how that kind of interacted. But it's interesting when he kind of comes over and he's supposed to assassinate these people, but he loves them, you mm-hmm. know? And I'm sure it was very strange for, you know, a lot of the Italian people at the time, because they all, you know, that whole region is really incestuous in a good way. but I mean, their borders are all close to each other. And as Americans, it's kind of weird to think of, but I mean, it would be like if Northern California attacked Oregon. It's just strange for them. And so it kind of goes into the themes of how, when at a certain point of time, our perspective and our biases point us towards like, oh yes, this is the way, I'm firmly a good boy for the fascist regime. But then once, you know, you're in a different place and around different people in a different social setting, how quickly we start to change and become different, and how our views start to change. And honestly, when he starts to be around the person he's supposed to assassinate,
yeah,
he not only starts to become more like them, you learn how much is similar between the two, and that they already had, he was a student of theirs.
Yeah.
So it's this very
heady kind of experience. Yeah.
It's this heady sort of experience, but I the reason why this kind of stuff sort of appeals to me in that way is it more washes over you, the themes, mm-hmm. and it's almost kind of how you feel about that. And to me, it's almost like I can relate to it more than I could to, let's say, if he just took it on and said, this is how fascism was, and this is how horrible it was.
Yeah.
Since he does it in this kind of way that kind of, I feel like it brings you in a little bit more personally through the themes and stuff like that, and through the perspective than it would if it was just like, if it was just straightforward plot, straightforward realism. In fact, I think that a lot of films now could benefit from that. You have to do it correctly, because if you do it with weird fucking dream sequences and madness people flying around and you just confuse your audience, that's one thing.
Well, and it also depends on the movie you're making, obviously.
That's true.
And I think, you know, what should be said about this movie is that while, yes, it's about a lot of things, and, you know, when you're talking about Italian fascism and this era and, you know, the way that it frames the story with the beginning and end of the fascist dictatorship of Mussolini, it's impossible not to think about these characters under those terms. I mean, the movie wants you to, but it's also a character piece first, most and foremost. It's I don't think the themes are ham-fistedly forcing the characters into doing things or anything like that. I think that it's more about this internal struggle. And what I think Bertolucci's doing is he's asking a lot of questions, like, what is the psychology of becoming a conformist. When you conform to ideology, where does that come from in your life? Like, how does that happen? And he proposes a lot of different kinds of personal trauma in this character's life, and then expands out to a greater context of national trauma.
Well, it's nuanced enough too that, like, you see a lot of different pieces, mm-hmm. instead of just seeing like, oh, this is the exact reason. Like, instead, it kind of, again, I have a little bit harder time sometimes contextualizing these kind of films, but I love them. But the reason I have a hard time contextualizing them is because it's more of an experience versus a like
straight narrative,
something yeah. that it's not just telling you, it's not handing you things.
Yeah.
And so it's much more about the feelings of that situation. So I think you on the other hand contextualize that very well. And if you're into these kind of things, mm-hmm. and you're into kind of experiencing a filmmaking that you don't see a lot now, and from a very wonderful period within film history, I think this might be a good thing to try out.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe for a standard viewer, it might be a little heady and a little scary to take on. I've bastardized my way through a lot of great, great directors, and I feel like I've learned a lot from them. You know, I think this is one that people should just give a shot. You have to try to adapt to the film's rhythm and their point of view versus being handed everything.
Right.
So I fully think people should try this, but I am just saying, It's not your typical, like, if you think this is going to be like the French Connection, it's not the fucking French Connection.
No, not exactly. And another thing, a positive I'll say, is it's beautifully shot. Like, Bertolucci knows how to frame
from then. Yeah.
Yeah, he knows how to frame something. And there's lots of very interesting, subtle camera stuff that he's doing where he's separating the characters in different rooms and they're lit in different ways. And the way that he picks... will isolate things in color and that's one of the things I like about European filmmaking, especially European filmmaking at this time, is that mm-hmm. style serves the story rather than distracts.
Well, they knew how to blend those elements so well. Like, again,
style and substance were intertwined.
Well, I mean, you can't watch movies from, you know, the States at this time and say the same thing.
No,
you know, a little bit after, once these movies have informed, like if you're talking a little bit later, and people who grew up watching these at the art theater, like Martin Scorsese, people like that,
and William Friedkin, and all of those 70s movie brats, yeah,
right, those guys who grew up with this stuff, sure, but like it's to me it's hard to get this kind of experience because it's such out of a place in time, and I'm like, well, I just always, when I watch something like that, I'm like, why don't we really see things? What was lost, and how do we get that? How can we get that back into some, like, I don't think it needs to be like in every blockbuster mm-hmm. or anything like that, but I, you know, seeing a film like this, it really, I don't know. I guess I get a little like, man, where is this? Where can we find more of this?
So. Well, you know, I think, Europe is there's still some interesting directors out there who are kind of working along these lines. I think a Michael Haneke is sort of still in this world. I think at his best, Refn kind of rubs elbows in this world.
Also, you could argue, what's his face, the Antichrist guy,
Lars von Trier, to a certain extent. Yeah, I mean, he, you know, the Dogma school and Winterberg and all of those guys. You know, I think generally speaking, the language of cinema is just a little more about emotion and feel and tone and these kind of things than American filmmaking, which has traditionally always been more narrative.
Yeah, they just have a soft touch. And mm-hmm. like, but I mean, that's the thing, is you can still get into the world as long as you're able to tap into it. Like, you can still get into all these worlds. Like, I wasn't raised in fascist Italy, but I understood the world of this place. Like, that's what I'm saying, is like, it's amazing to me what they can capture.
Right.
Even though it's very dreamlike and strange.
Well, and it's also just interesting to see history this well documented, and, you know, which has been covered to death in all film and all literature, from the perspective of the people who were really living in it. And it was, you know, 1970 was not that long after.
No.
This was still well into their recent memory. This would be like us thinking about 1989.
Yeah, or even just like 9/11 happening.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so what do you have for us next week?
Next week I have a documentary for you called The Final Member.
And for some reason I'm not allowed to read or know anything about it.
No, I just want you to go into it and enjoy it.
I'm worried, Richard.
I know. You had that controlling thing in you. You just, you know, you want to know. But if you don't, you might have a good experience. Just try it out.
A good experience, or are you going to traumatize me for life?
Maybe both. Both, hopefully.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy, Richard. The Final Member. Okay, well, that's what we're talking about next week. If anybody who listens to the show did happen to catch The Bronze, if you were one of the 12 people who paid to see it in theaters, besides me and Richard, or if you've seen The Conformist, or if you want to wax philosophical about Italian New Wave of the 70s, or Bertolucci, or if you've happened to see The Final Member, I guess I won't read any of that until next week either, but send us an email at jabberandthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast. We're on Twitter. Follow us there at jabberpodcast, all one word. Subscribe to us and listen to us on Stitcher or what are the other things we're on? iTunes, player.fm, Zune, and the Windows Podcast Network, as well as Pocket Cast. And I know that people are listening to us specifically on Pocket Cast. I have reviews. I write them. They're archived at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com. I also have a couple reviews over at the Seattle-based website, MacGuffin at MacGuff.in/author/Cassidy. Check out Brad's blog over at his, it's kind of litzine/blog thingy called medium.com/panel-frame. And be sure to check out the other shows that we're sometimes on, or they're sometimes on our show, our friends out there, Leland over at his comedy podcast, dampercast.com, Rod and Denise at their music request podcast, The Listening Party, and Patrick, who was just on last week's episode and helped us talk about Batman v Superman, go back and listen to that if you haven't, over his two podcasts out of Detroit, Make Dad Read Comics and Almost Educational. And I'm supposed to be on an episode of Almost Educational later this week, I think. And that's it. That's the show.
Let's do it again next week.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.